this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
More than 10 times as many Americans, about 75,000, die of occupational disease. Not right away, but they die earlier than they otherwise would have.
Former OSHA whistleblower and current occupational and environmental scientist Dr. Adam Finkel discusses safety and health issues on American job sites.
It's basically just workers or just individuals who are doing a job, training artificial intelligence. They have no idea that they're doing it. They have no idea what it's for. They have no idea the harm it might bring them or the community. And so that's what they're turning all of us into.
As AI and robotics reshape the workplace, are workers' rights being left behind? Adrian Williams sounds the alarm from inside the tech front line.
Basically, President Trump has launched an all-out attack on the federal workforce and federal labor.
Federal unions are under attack, with Trump and Musk targeting worker contracts. But the fight back is building. We hear from American Federation of Government Employees Vice President David Gonzalez on what's at stake. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. University of Michigan professor Dr. Adam Finkel is a former OSHA whistleblower and current occupational and environmental scientist. He spoke to Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke about safety on American job sites and the consequence of Trump's budget cuts to federal regulatory agencies.
This is Thomas O'Rourke with Pacifica Radio's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm speaking today to Dr. Adam Finkel, who is an expert in industrial and environmental safety and health. Welcome, Dr. Finkel.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Dr. Finkel, please give our listeners some of your relevant background in the fields of occupational health and safety, environmental health, and risk management.
So I'm very broadly trained. I am one of the relatively few people who has extensive training in risk assessment and risk management, basically the science of thinking about what harm can happen to people in the environment, trying to put numbers on how likely those things are, how severe they are, and then trying to, in my professional life, I was the chief regulator at OSHA in the Clinton administration, trying to set national standards so that these risks can be minimized without undue harm to the economy.
You were a supervisor at an OSHA regional office, is that correct?
Right. After I was in charge of regulations at OSHA for 4 years, I was got a chance to move out to Denver, and I was in charge of all the OSHA operations in that part of the country in the Rocky Mountain area.
And this was during the George W. Bush administration.
Right.
When you became a whistleblower about the exposure to not only your own inspectors, but more broadly, the factory workers in workplaces where the element beryllium was present. What is beryllium toxicity exposure? Is it still a major concern? And what are some of the lessons you learned from your experience as a whistleblower?
So beryllium is still around. It's used in the aircraft industry and in high-tech machining and computers. It is not dangerous when touched or if you were to ingest small particles, but if you inhale finely ground particles of beryllium, it causes a unique lung disease called chronic beryllium disease. So it's one of the half a dozen or so agents that have diseases named after it, because there's no other way to get this disease but by exposure. And my boss at the time, John Henshaw, under G.W. Bush, did not want to offer our own employees who do job inspections a relatively new but well-established medical test, a blood test, cost about $200 a person, that would have told these inspectors which of them were partway along the pathway to this terrible disease and then could probably stop being exposed to beryllium when they did inspections. So I complained about it to a reporter after 18 months of trying to get him to change his mind. And as soon as the story came out without my name in it, he knew it was me and tried to fire me. So I sued the agency and I got a big settlement and left government, which I miss. But the lesson, one of the lessons is OSHA is, among other things, the nation's whistleblower adjudication agency. They look at not only workplace whistleblowers, but under the Sarbanes-Oxley Enron Act, EPA whistleblowers, pipeline safety. And I learned that they're really not set up to do a good job because they have had always had a bias against the employee. So I got targeted for being a dissenter, and I don't think that agency should be allowed to be a neutral arbiter of these things because they really don't have their heart in it.
I read some of the background materials that you sent along, and in one section there was an academic debate that you seem to have initiated in an article you published in Human and Ecological Risk Assessment back in July of 2011, entitled Solution-Focused Risk Assessment, a proposal for the fusion of environmental analysis and action. Could you, in just a brief amount of time, explain for our audience what solution-focused risk assessment is and what are some of the major results of that debate are?
So, risk assessment is a terrific way to decide sort of what to worry about and how much to worry. And it's a good way to set a goal. So we used to have a goal of 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That was an aspiration. We've now gone past that. But the goals don't tell you anything about how to get there. And so they have a tendency to just sit there, and after the deadline, you say, well, we didn't quite meet our goal. And so a solution-focused approach would be not asking what to worry about, but asking what can we do and what of the things that we can do are most worth doing. And so it's much more practical, it's much more focused on we have products that fulfill human needs. The example I always use is the plastic water bottle. EPA has decided that that's a quote unquote a problem because the water contains parts per trillion or parts per billion of various compounds that are endocrine disruptors and other materials. So their idea is if we can make the water arbitrarily safe and clean and fewer parts per billion of any of these things, then our job is done. But that doesn't do anything for the 50 billion water bottles that we produce every year, using a lot of energy and that then all go into landfills where they release the plastic into the ground. A solution-focused approach says we're trying to provide people with ready access to cold, clean, safe drinking water. How could we do that? Well, we already knew how to do that when I was a kid. We had drinking fountains everywhere. And we've now been told that we need this thing that costs $3 or $4 and that has this tremendous environmental footprint. And where we had zero of them when I was a kid, now we have 50 billion of them. So solution focus is saying, what are we trying to do here? And can we use infrastructure or taxes or incentives or technology to solve the problem rather than just throw up our hands and say, wow, now we've got, unsafe water in our water bottles.
You didn't even mention that what's come out in the last year or so, this is nanoparticles of plastic that are
Right.
now being ingested and metabolized,
Right.
things like that, and of course the plastic in these oceanic gyres that are
Exactly.
killing everything that encounters it. It seems like
Yeah.
certainly fish.
Yeah. And I love that example only because I'm old enough to remember we had already provided the human need before this thing was invented. Now, there are other examples like we don't miss typewriters because we have a better thing than the typewriter. We have a personal computer now. The people who made the typewriters, some of them were out of job, some of the executives had to find other work, but I once carried a sign at a climate rally. We don't miss typewriters and we're not going to miss coal. And if we could just have the political will to say, we want coal to be like the typewriter, we know better ways to heat homes than with coal, but we're not willing to do that.
Thank you for that. If you had been able to ensure that this model, this solution-focused model, was implemented, how might it have altered our government and others' response to the SARS-CoV-19 so-called pandemic? Also, what mistakes or lies, as you know, were made by the Fauci, Collins, Trump, and Biden regimes regarding risk management during this public health event? And I ask this because, based on the last question, if the declarations of emergency proclaimed by government public health officialdom in order to spur quick approval of funding for rapid dissemination of these newly engineered mRNA genetic therapies that were called vaccine had not happened, how might your solution-focused risk assessment model have dealt with this global public health event? And I know you know something about masks, so if you use that as an example, that would be wonderful too.
Sure. I was the lead author of the federal OSHA standard on respiratory protection in 1998. So I know a lot about respirators and masks. And the great irony is,
Workers breathing in factories, correct? Generally, that was the idea.
right, but not only against chemicals and dust and fibers, but against infectious disease as well. So
I
we
see.
had a standard that never came out, casualty of the Bush election in 2000, to regulate tuberculosis in the workplace. So we would have had a stockpile of N95 respirators, under $1 a piece, comfortable, safe, and very, very effective. And so when people say masks don't work, there are actually two kinds of people who say that. Ignorant people who don't think that any face covering works, and they don't like the idea because they say it's tyranny. And then smart people who know something about industrial hygiene who know that, in fact, masks, as in bandanas, surgical masks, do-it-yourself cloth, they don't work. But masks, as in N95 or better respirators, do work. And Fauci didn't understand that at the beginning. And the Biden administration really never picked up on this either. Even until the last day, the CDC under Biden had a committee that was recommending surgical masks instead of N95s. And the difference is night and day. And we would have saved a lot of lives if we had promulgated, good advice for people at the beginning.
Yeah, because my understanding is surgical masks are basically designed to be worn by surgeons to prevent them from infecting a patient on a surgical table, correct?
Exactly. And they don't even work terrifically well for that. But yeah, if
Yeah.
you sneeze into one, it captures some of what you sneeze out, but it's useless almost against viruses and bacteria. Now, the vaccines, not really my area of expertise, but you said lies. And I think it's very hard in hindsight to distinguish between overconfidence, honest mistakes, a hope that was not realized, and lying. Because my opinion is that Fauci and the others really did have a good reason for hope that these first generation vaccines would stop transmission or reduce transmission. It turned out that they don't really do that very well. Nevertheless, they reduce severity, and that's a been a huge benefit.
Okay, we'll leave that alone and move on to this, which is please explain briefly the field of occupational or workplace risk assessment and management and how our NIOSH, that is the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, supposed to work together. What progress has been made and what are some of the emerging risks of workplace safety?
So I think the country does not understand. Most adults spend half their working hours at work, and occupational safety and health. Well, occupational safety, the accidents that occur at work. OSHA's done a tremendous job reducing the death toll. It used to be in the tens of thousands per year. Now it's been pretty steady at about 4 to 5,000 per year. So electrocutions, amputations, traffic accidents, workplace violence.
This is Americans dying on the job.
Right, dying on the job, about 15 a day or 5,000 a year.
That doesn't
But
include the black lung for, happens years later, or does it?
exactly, no. And the point is that more than 10 times as many Americans, about 75,000, die of occupational disease. Not right away, but they die earlier than they otherwise would have. So it's actually the ninth leading cause of death in the country, and people simply don't appreciate that. So President Nixon in 1970 created OSHA and NIOSH and EPA all within about a year of each other, and you say work together, they were created to not work together. They were created in three different places in government, and they have often not cooperated or not been allowed to cooperate because particularly the Republican government has said that's ganging up on business. So we don't want these agencies to cooperate. We want them to be kept at arm's length from each other. And that has caused inefficiency, but also perversely, I mean, EPA's mission is to get the pollution away from people from like 5 o'clock in the afternoon to nine the next morning when they live in their communities. And one way to do that is to keep the pollution bottled up inside the workplaces. OSHA's job is to get it out of the workplace. And so they're happy when the doors and the windows open and the smokestacks go up and the pollution gets away from the workers. What we need to do is address both of them. And EPA has just recently begun doing that. There was a revision of the Toxic Substance Control Act called the Lautenberg Act about 7 years ago. And there's one word in that 100-page bill, the word workers. And it's given EPA actually a legal mandate to ban or reduce particular chemicals in commerce and also to help workers. And OSHA has never been able to really do that in 55 years because of political opposition.
Yeah, and contradictory instructions, kind of, so to speak.
Right,
How
but
do you
EPA's
think?
always been 20 times the budget, 20 times the size of OSHA, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing. The environment's a big place, but OSHA's always been secondary, always been under siege, always been told by Congress, you can't do this, you can't do that.
NIOSH is part of which agency? Is it HHS or?
Yeah, it's under CDC and HHS, and so now in the last couple of months, RFK Jr. has completely decimated that agency. 90% of the people have been fired. This is $1 per year per American to do all of the research on occupational disease and injury. And for the savings of $1 a year, these workers are all now on their own. It's a ruthless, monstrous, brainless, heartless activity.
That leads me to the next question. How do you think the current administration's proposed cuts at this point, they're proposed within HHS, EPA, and labor, will impact workers on the job in today's work sites? Have these types of cuts happened before? And to what effect, in your estimation, in terms of knowledge, capacity, we could say institutional knowledge, capacity, and real world consequences, will these cuts have?
So cuts of similar size have happened before at OSHA and EPA, and they've usually lasted for 4 years, and they've been able to rebuild. But the NIOSH cuts are unprecedented. That agency, if it's not reversed soon, will it'll be hard to ever reconstitute it. And yeah, for whether it's 4 years or longer, more people will die. Die on the job, and more people will die earlier in life after the job, because we've turned our back on them. And this is to some extent Trump's base, and I hope they're beginning to understand that he has given him a big thumb in the eye and said, you're on your own. Joni Ernst from Ohio said yesterday, "We're all going to die." Well, yeah, we're all going to die, but we would like to live long, productive, normal lives, not be hastened to our grave by ignorant policymakers.
That was University of Michigan public health and occupational safety scientist Dr. Adam Finkel speaking to Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke.
It's a big job just getting by with nine kids and a wife. But I've been working, man, dang near all my life, and I'll keep on working. Long as my two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working man blues. I'll keep my nose on the grindstone, work hard every day. I might get a little tired on the weekend. After I draw my pay, I'll go back working. Come Monday morning, I'm right back with the crew. I'll drink a little beer that evening, sing a little bit of these working man blues. Sometimes I think about leaving, do a little bumming around. I want to throw my bills out the window, catch a train to another town. I'll go back working. I gotta buy my kids a brand new pair of shoes. I drink a little beer in a tavern, cry a little bit of these working man blues. Here comes that working man.
That was Merle Haggard singing Working Man Blues. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasiliev. The rise of AI and robotics in the workplace isn't just changing jobs, it's threatening the rights and lives of workers here and around the world. Adrian Williams, a former Amazon employee and now with the Distributed AI Research Institute, DARE, shares her firsthand experience and warns about the dangers this technology poses to working people and their basic freedoms.
So Adrian, why don't you first talk about how you got into the issue of technology and AI?
I took such a non-traditional path. It was never my goal to be like doing what I'm doing now. I'm very happy I'm doing it. My degree is in graphic design. And I mean, that was one of the first jobs that I felt really was in danger as this technology started going, at least creative jobs. And by 2014, I was training my replacement in the Philippines at my job. So, I had to leave that career and I went to be a teacher for a while at a CZI, Chan Zuckerberg Initiative charter school, not understanding the charter school system, not understanding the tech that was involved, and very quickly started to realize like, oh wait, they're not even teaching my kids. The kids are just kind of a byproduct of this online learning platform that they've created. So I started, you know, just trying to organize parents, teachers, other staff and admin from other Summit public schools, because there's 11 of them. And it got to be too stressful, just too much. You know, again, like you said, I was a single mom at the time. My daughter was in kindergarten and it was too stressful because of the pushback from the school. So I stopped working there. And then again, just not knowing, I was like, my bright idea is I'm going to go drive for Amazon. It's a solo gig. I can get my head together. I can figure out a next step. And just immediately I started noticing kind of the same. You would think of these as being two completely different opposite ends of the spectrum kind of industries, education and Amazon, you know, commercial delivery and stuff like that. But I started noticing the same things, like the over-surveillance of everyone involved, the complete just dismissing of health and safety laws, the wage theft, things like that, that I was noticing at the school, I started noticing at Amazon. So before the pandemic, I was working at Amazon and I started kind of lightly organizing, you know, how you start, you just like asking those questions and having people talk about, oh, don't you think we should get paid more? Don't you think that this is unsafe? That kind of stuff. And then the pandemic hit and everything went into overdrive. And so because of that, I was, you know, I was organizing then. And honestly, it was just this organic thing where like my organizing led me to meet this person or that person. And I went on a panel one day with Timnit Gebru, who was a former Google employee who was fired for basically calling out the ethics or the unethical behavior of the algorithms at Google. And Alex Hanna, who is now my research director, and that's how I met them. And that's how I have the job I have now. So it was very organic, but it was totally not what I had expected my life to be.
Okay. So you had this experience during COVID and the conditions at Amazon were pretty horrendous for a lot of workers. Maybe you can talk about that and the speed ups, the situation that drivers are under and workers are under at Amazon.
Yeah, it's weird because when I first started working at Amazon, you know, it really wasn't that bad. I used to wear this little Samsung watch because I wanted to just track, like, I wonder how many steps I get every day. And I got about 5,000 to 6,500 steps a day. But then when COVID hit, that doubled and I was getting between 10,000 and 11,000 steps a day. And it's like, okay, so your route has doubled. There's still an expectation that you're going to get it done in the same amount of time. So you have some workers that have 8-hour shifts, some have 10, some have 12. However it doubled for them, there's still the expectation that you're going to get it done in 8, 10, 12 hours. That's when I really started noticing and hearing things about like, well, I can't go to the bathroom. I'm not eating lunch. I'm not taking breaks, because the expectation was to get it done. That was when COVID hit and the pandemic, you know, people needed stuff and they were bored, and I get it. But there was this kind of attitude that was like, well, we don't really care if there's a pandemic, right? We're not going to make sure you have masks. We're not going to clean the vans. We're not going to put any kind of PSAs out for customers to say like, hey, let's keep our drivers safe. And then when there would be cases, they would tell the DSP owners that, so, you know, Amazon drivers aren't technically Amazon employees. They work for small business owners. Amazon would tell those small business owners to keep that information from us. Don't tell them that there's cases in your DSP. Don't tell them there's cases at the warehouse. And so, you know, that became unsustainable as people have other lives. They have little kids. They have older parents and family members, and it became really dangerous to work for that kind of job.
And there was organizing that was going on there, and Amazon apparently spent a lot of money and effort to shut it down.
Yeah, my particular warehouse, I there were little pockets of individuals, and Amazon shut it down quick. Even with me, it was very quickly like they were on me like white on rice. So things that I used to be able to do, like going to the break room. Now, oh no, you're not an employee. You can't go in the break room. But that was never a thing before I started organizing. There was targeting, I feel, of my actual DSP boss, of my actual boss, because they would send him things like, hey, she's up to stuff. Handle this, fix this, shut her down. And my boss was kind of like, she's a grown person. She can do what she wants. I feel a little guilty. I feel like, and I know he would never say this, but I feel like I'm partially responsible for why he no longer has a DSP. Because the expectation from Amazon is that your workers are not going to organize, your workers are not going to unionize, they're going to fall in line, or you're going to fire them. And any boss that doesn't, you know, kind of toe that line, they'll pull their contract.
And it's illegal, but they seem to get away with violating the law.
Yep.
Above the law.
They are above the law. There's so many things that are illegal. I mean, they were just blatantly hiring intelligence analysts to go after and target organizers. They put that out in like a Indeed job search. So they know nobody is going to stop them. And so they shut it down. They wanted to find, you know, dirt on organizers so they could get restraining orders, so that they could find ways to either get them arrested or have them so scared that they would just stop organizing and shut their mouths. All that union busting stuff is illegal.
And you began to study the role of technology, AI, and confront this technology and how it was going to be used for people, and the use of it discriminating against people and targeting people. What did you learn in grappling with this technology and what it means to the working class and people at large?
Yeah, I think the most shocking thing that I learned, because I didn't know about any of this until I started getting a little sense of it when I was working at the school. But when I started working at DARE, what I started realizing is there's this whole system that we don't realize is happening, because AI only works if it's trained, right? And it needs all these data points. So every single thing we do online, that's data given to them. But for a worker, and I'll give you the example of Amazon delivery drivers, is like, you know, companies are very excited about autonomous vehicles. Amazon drivers have those artificial intelligence cameras, those Netradyne cameras on the inside and outside of their vans. And the inside of the vans gets a lot of attention, rightfully so, because it's invasive and the drivers feel a certain way about it. And, you know, it doesn't even help really, but it's just such an invasion of privacy. But the cameras on the outside of the van are, to me, just so crazy, because what it's doing is collecting road data. It's collecting millions and millions and millions of miles of road data. And now you have car companies that partner with the companies collecting this road data so they can get it for free so that they can create their autonomous vehicles. Now, there is, if you go to our own Homeland Security website, they talk about forced labor and they talk about it in three different ways. And the first two ways are, you know, what you think of. It's like, hey, I was walking down the street, somebody kidnapped me, and now I'm making garments in this factory and I don't want to be here. Forced labor. Or I went on a job interview and they locked the door and I can't get out, and now I'm working for them. Forced labor. But there's a third one called forced labor by way of fraud that says if I have job A and I'm making, you know, $20 an hour for job A, but there's this invisible job B that's bringing in a revenue for a company, that is forced labor by way of fraud, and that's illegal. And that's exactly what's happening with the Amazon delivery drivers. Some of them sign consent forms. A lot of them that I've interviewed don't. But what's happening is it is a job. I mean, you can look at Waymo. They hire people as surveyors to run around town and survey and get road data. That's a job. But the Amazon delivery drivers are doing it for free. And so I wrote an op-ed in Newsweek about the idea of zombie trainers. And it's basically just workers or just individuals who are doing a job, training artificial intelligence. They have no idea that they're doing it. They have no idea what it's for. They have no idea the harm it might bring them or the community. And so that's what they're turning all of us into. So workers, yes, but pretty much all of us are doing it. School children, prisoners, refugees, low-wage workers are all behaving as zombie trainers and don't realize it and should be getting paid a lot more.
And of course, they don't want people to know what's going on as they introduce this technology. There's no control of this technology. And the development of AI, they want to regulate it themselves. What does that mean, Sam Altman and Musk and these companies regulating Altman? I mean, they don't really want any regulation. Their ideology is that. Why don't you talk about this regulation and the lack of it in the United States and internationally?
Yeah, there is a huge lack of it. Well, Sam Altman went on like a world tour to all the, you know, governments that were going to bring this technology into their fold, and basically were feeding it's just all snake oil. You know, like this idea that AI is going to be so powerful that it's going to be your best friend and your teacher and your therapist and all these things. That's a false narrative. It can't do that. AI does not think. It does not learn. It doesn't feel. It has no empathy. It has no nuance. But they're selling this dream that it's going to be able to do all these things. And these governments are eating it up. The thing is that data is the money. The data is the money. And so that's why they don't want any regulations. Because if you start regulating it, then all of a sudden they don't have free reign and free access to everyone's data. That's the real pressure point right now, is we don't want people to understand that the data is money. We don't want them to start wanting to own their own data or transparency around how their data is used. So if we can get these governments to just say, it doesn't even matter, we just need it so bad. That's how the governments are right now. We just need it so bad. We can't let this government be above us. So we just have to let them do whatever they want, because otherwise another government will get there first. There's nothing to get to. There's nothing to get to.
And one of the logics of the development of AI is to eliminate workers and to have this technology eliminate workers. Yet doesn't capitalism rely on workers to buy products?
That's the thing that never made sense to me. And I want to tell you what's scary to me about that whole thing is that, for one, there are certain jobs that automation can probably replace. That's not artificial intelligence necessarily. It's just automation. But the scary part to me is that, one, they want to replace care work. So teachers, nurses, therapists, things like that. Because AI cannot care, it's very dangerous to replace care work with artificial intelligence. It will fail every time. But the other part of it, because they are so like stuck on getting rid of all the workers, is you're starting to hear people like Elon Musk and Sam Altman and Bill Gates double back on this idea of universal basic income, which at first sounds like this great idea, right? I mean, back when Martin Luther King was championing universal basic income, it was to subsidize a low wage job. What they're trying to do is say, we want to make sure we get for universal basic income because there won't be a job. that's a level of corporate control we've never seen, where essentially they're going to be doling us out an allowance and there won't be any work. And then think about that in terms of people fighting back. Like, if we fight back and no one has a job and no one, you know, makes their own money, then they can cut that money off whenever they want to keep us at bay. That part is what I think scares me the most as I hear them more and more talk about universal basic income, because it means what they want to do is control everything.
That was Adrian Williams with Distributed AI Research Institute, DAIR-institute.org, speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. That was Neil Young, Computer Age. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. Trump and Musk moved quickly to bust federal workers' unions by gutting contracts for over 800,000 government employees, including members of the American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE. Now the union is fighting back. Veterans and VA workers are rallying in Washington, D.C. on June 6th. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer spoke with AFGE Vice President David Gonzalez about the impact on workers and the public.
So, David, why don't you talk about who you represent and what your union is about?
I'm the 2nd District National Vice President, and my area coverage is from New Jersey, New York State, and all the New England states all the way to Maine. AFGE, we're a federal union, and we represent the federal employees, all the federal employees in various agencies from the DOD, Department of Justice, VA, EPA, HUD, Department of Ed, all the federal agencies. We have members in various federal agencies, and we have 800,000 members.
Under Project 2025, that project, which President Trump denied he was aware of, didn't know anything about it, part of Project 2025 is to privatize public services and to say that public workers and federal workers can't have unions. You think that what's going on now, and maybe you can talk about what the federal government has done to disenfranchise your members and public workers to have union rights and to be able to organize?
Basically, President Trump has launched an all-out attack on the federal workforce and federal labor and federal labor union, AFGE. We think it's in retaliation because we stepped up and we challenged him when when he first launched his attack with USAID and the probationary employees and so forth. We have a lot of litigation. We have still have some litigation pending currently against the government, against the Trump administration. And we just think that it's an all-out attack on the federal labor union, our union in particular.
And what exactly has Trump done to prevent your union from organizing and also representing members?
He signed an executive order basically taking collective bargaining rights away from our AFG members in our agencies, taking away contracts that have existed for over 50 or in 60 years and attack working conditions and conditions of employment that go against labor statute, against federal law. And so he's done quite harm to our members.
And what does that mean specifically, taking away labor protections as far as working on the job and that the conditions that you have?
Sure. He's taken away, for example, he's taken away policies or negotiated agreements between agencies for, let's say, using seniority, for getting annual leave and things of that nature when they put in for their annual leave, taking away sick leave procedures, taking away holidays and negotiated holidays and things of that nature, taking away all kinds of various rights that were bargained and processes that were bargained with these agencies on behalf of federal employees.
And also, I understand they basically de-recognize the union. And if you're trying to represent workers, what does that mean? What does that entail now that you're not the bargaining agent according to the government?
He took away the contracts in these unions. So now the agencies don't have to adhere to a collective bargaining agreement. So for instance, they don't have to use seniority. I spoke of seniority for annual leave. They can make up their own processes.
How is this connected with DOGE and what Musk has done? Because a lot of your members have been terminated, probationary employees. How has that affected your membership?
Oh, morale is low throughout the federal government, and federal employees are scared. They're scared for their jobs. They're scared for their employment, and nobody wants to lose their job. So the morale is definitely low throughout the federal government.
There have been protests around the country. Particularly this coming June 6th, there's going to be a protest of VA workers and also vets who are worried that they're not going to be able to get the benefits that they need to survive. Their high level of suicides, rate of suicides among vets, phone services, all kinds of service. In the Veterans Administration, what has this meant to your members and also to veterans getting the services they need to keep going?
Well, a third of the federal workforce are veterans. Veterans, they basically, when they serve when they serve their country, they just basically come home and they just switch uniforms and they go into the civilian workforce in the federal government, continue to serve the American people in a different fashion. So, in the VA, they want to lay off 80,000 VA employees this coming month, and that'll cripple the VA. As it is, the VA is already short-staffed in a lot of areas, and especially like in nursing and doctors and things of that nature. So they're already short-staffed and suffering in the VA. And so this is political suicide that the government is doing against the veterans when they're talking about laying off 80,000 VA employees. And like I said, a third of the federal workforce are veterans. And when you spoke about the probationary employees, that includes probationary employees that are veterans that come home and they get a job in the federal government and they just switch uniforms and they're still continuing to serve the American people in a different capacity. And to come home and to lose your job like that After serving your country, and instead of paying a debt of gratitude to our veterans and treating them with the reveration that they deserve, and to be revered for their service and their sacrifice, they come home to this.
And the termination of probationary employees, the justification of that, apparently from reports, was that the cause when there was no real cause. And has that caused a situation where these people who have been laid off, these federal workers who have been laid off, can't even get their unemployment, can't even get compensation to keep going and pay their bills?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's been issues with unemployment. State governors had to step in and assist the federal government. We've been working hand in hand. I know in my district, I've been working with the state politicians, with governors and state political figures to assist and to take the red tape out of trying to get unemployment and different things for the federal workers who have been displaced.
And the issue of the government saying they want to get rid of diversity, they don't believe that. I mean, they're even trying to say that they don't even want to teach about the Civil War anymore and about slavery in this country. A large number of public workers are black workers. They've been able to come into civil service. What is the relationship of that to what you're facing? You think that it's particularly targeting black workers in the United States?
Absolutely. DEI is, it's not just about race when he attacks DEI, because DEI has the disabled, whether we're going to have a ramp in the federal workforce, whether we're going to have handicapped parking out there for those people who work in an agency who needs to be close to an entrance and those types of things. So it's not just about race, even though we feel in a lot of areas that he is targeting by race, but working in the federal government is a pathway to the middle class for most African Americans that are employed and veterans coming home. That's a straight pathway to the middle class. And by taking away these opportunities of working in the federal government, he's taken away the pathway to a middle class lifestyle for American patriots who serve our country.
And this issue of dismantlement of agencies, so they believe that companies should regulate themselves. We don't need EPA, we don't need OSHA, and your members are in these agencies. What is this going to mean to the American people if these agencies are eliminated? The Department of Education, I mean, there's so many agencies that they want to basically destroy. Is that the dismantlement of the government? And what is it going to mean for working people in this country and your members?
Well, loss of jobs again for our members, but for most important for the American people. I was just reading today how NOAA, he's got rid of all the meteorologists and stuff in NOAA, and here we are coming on hurricane season, and in a couple days we're gonna hit hurricane season up until October, and they don't even have enough meteorologists to predict the weather and things of that nature to work overnight and monitor the weather for tornadoes and hurricanes and things of that nature. Just an example. He's getting rid of science. People who are working on cures for cancer when he's dismantling these agencies. People who help with poverty, programs that help with poverty in the reconciliation budget, they want to do away with SNAP, after school programs, feeding programs for our kids when they go to school. Most of those programs, like for instance, those feeding programs in schools, if you look in the inner city, studies will tell you that most of the time that's the only meal that a lot of children receive is when they go to school.
And we have, as you were saying, a hurricane, major hurricane season. They expect possibly 8, 9 major hurricanes in the United States, particularly in the South, Texas, Florida. And yet FEMA seems to be on a destruction mission under the administration. What is this going to mean without FEMA for these states that face hurricanes, for the working people, regular people, cities, communities, who are already suffering? In North Carolina, they're still trying to recuperate, it seems.
Exactly. I mean, the administration is basically saying, fend for yourself, America. Do your own thing. When you don't have FEMA to help and aid and assist with housing, with temporary housing, with food and stuff, if you have a hurricane or a big tornado or or a fire like out in the West where they always have wildfires and things, they're wiping out whole communities. So now you don't have FEMA to assist with temporary housing and medical and the things of that nature that the American people will need when they're suffering during a catastrophe, a weather catastrophe like that. And it's just disgraceful how he has upended that and came with the mentality, like I said, to fend for yourself.
Also, you have a situation, for example, in the FAA with the airlines where they have not hired enough air flight control operators. They have to close down because they don't have enough operators. They have more accidents, less oversight of these agencies. It seems like we're heading towards a major catastrophic situation in our airports.
Exactly. The FAA, for example, they were already short-staffed. The FAA, they needed people. They were in a situation where they needed more people to be on the work in the workplace. And so now you put a freeze on hiring. That was one of the first things that the administration did when they came in. They put an executive order putting a freeze on hiring in the federal workforce. And so, and then now you have these catastrophes. You get rid of collective bargaining rights for TSA, the people who makes our skies safe and things of that nature. So now they're not able to be unionized and be respected in the workplace. So he made us less safe when we travel now by some of the things that he'd done.
Of course, if federal workers are attacked and their unions are derecognized, that's going to spread to the rest of the working class. As we talked about, as far as PATCO, that was used to the defeat by Reagan of the PATCO workers was then used to destroy other unions throughout the country. Employers, bosses said, "We don't have to negotiate, take a hike."
Yeah, basically. Yeah, I mean, I'm very concerned about that. I'm very concerned about the attack on labor and our union, especially. I think that he has a personal vendetta against us because we was one of the first federal unions that came out on him as soon as he launched his first executive order on our members. We're in this for the long haul.
And on June 6th, the rally that's going to be held for the veterans and to protect VA, my union, the CWA, I'm the Journalist Union News Guild, has sent out a notice. The CWA sent out a notice saying that we should support this. And you think all workers should be there? All working people should mobilize for around saving the VA and defending the vets?
Absolutely, absolutely. That is an honorable cause. I'll be there June the 6th. I'll be there in DC for the rally for our veterans in support of our veterans. As I said, I'm a disabled veteran myself, and I'm going to be there. And everyone should be there if they can, especially our veterans. We have to fight for our own cause, and this will be a way that we can bring awareness and let people know that we're not taking this, and that we're in this to the end, that we're not going to go nowhere as a union, as labor, or as veterans.
That was American Federation of Government Employees District 2 National Vice President David Gonzalez speaking with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. You can find out more about the June 6th National Veterans Rally in Washington, D.C. at unite4veterans.org. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Thomas O'Rourke, Steve Zeltzer, and myself, Polina Vasilyev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.